Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Abuse of prescription drugs has become an increasing public health problem in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that sales of prescription drugs have quadrupled over the last decade. Oklahoma ranks number one in deaths attributed to prescription drug overdoses. My guest today, Dr. William Yarbrough, is the medical director and a pain management specialist at the Internal Medicine Clinic at the University of Oklahoma School of Community Medicine here in Tulsa. He also serves as the medical director of 12 and 12, the Center for Addiction Treatment and Recovery here in Tulsa. On today's show, we'll discuss his experiences in treating both chronic pain and addiction and the often fine line that runs between the two. Dr. William Yarbrough is my guest today at Studio Tulsa on Health. William Yarbrough, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start by asking you about the scope of the problem. How big of a problem is prescription drug abuse here in Oklahoma?
It's considered to be a major problem in Oklahoma as well as nationally. You hear things about Oklahoma being the worst state in the country. It probably isn't that when you look at statistics, but it is significant in Oklahoma.
Do we know statistics on, say, you know, morbidity and mortality from prescription drug abuse?
Well, it's oft quoted that deaths associated, accidental deaths or intentional deaths associated with overdosages have now outstripped deaths on the highway, for instance, to put it into some perspective. But I think it's important to understand the difference between abuse that leads to death and addiction itself. Those are kind of different issues. And sometimes for policy, we get these lumped into one basket and we solve these problems possibly in different ways.
Why is the problem worse in Oklahoma, say, than in other states?
Well, it's interesting. There was a study I read last year, epidemiologic study, looking at all the states, actually on a county-by-county basis. This was about opiates mostly, and found that the states that had the biggest problems were more prescription drugs, opiate drugs were prescribed, were states that had high poverty levels and had low rates of insured patients. And they also looked at this on a milligram of prescribing per capita. That's where I say Oklahoma ranked 13th when you looked at it that way, not in the top 10. You know, possibly if you look at how many Lortab prescriptions are written, say, which is a narcotic, for per capita, maybe we're higher. But when you look at the actual prescribing, it appears we're somewhere around 12th or 13th. But in this article, they concluded that the lack of health insurance in certain areas seemed to drive this up, where often doctors might not have very many options to treat these patients other than with simple pain medications, people with back pain, joint pains, et cetera, because they didn't have access to further testing and other treatments. For instance, in Oklahoma, for the most part, adult Medicaid patients can't get physical therapy unless it's post-surgical. So, you know, I suspect it's that way in many states. So what was postulated was partially related was poverty level and then the lack of health insurance.
So it's easier to give your patient a prescription for an opioid for a strong pain medicine than it is because the insurance they have won't allow physical therapy.
Won't allow physical therapy, or potentially you can't get an MRI scan to see what exactly might be wrong with their back. You can't possibly get a neurosurgeon or an orthopedist to see them to evaluate their back, and not that they can cure their back. So you're wound up with, this is really an inexpensive pain medication is all that is left to do. I don't know what part of the problem is that, but it appears in the study to have been a problem. And, you know, doctors are trained to try to help people, and sometimes you're left with less choices than at other times based on insurance.
So you want to do the best you can by the patient, and if what they're allowed to get, in a sense, in terms of services is limited, you're going to go with what will help.
Yes.
And is this how people get hooked, so to speak? I mean, a lot of patients will say, oh, I don't want to take Vicodin, Lortab, Codeine, because I don't want to be hooked. I don't want to get addicted. Is that how it starts?
It can start. Only probably most studies would say somewhere between 5 and 20% of patients who get prescribed chronic narcotic medications for pain actually get addicted to them. They may get dependent that if they're suddenly stopped, they have withdrawal symptoms, but they don't abuse them. Interestingly enough, anywhere from 60 to 80% of people who are addicted to them that come into a treatment center are not getting them directly from a doctor.
60 to 80%?
Yes. They are getting them from a family member or a friend. The family member may be getting them from a doctor. The friend may be getting them from a doctor, but the addict themselves often is not getting them from a doctor. So there appears to be a go-between phenomena that goes on here with the diversion of these drugs from what might be a legitimate patient or a legitimate appearing patient who possibly is taking part of their pain medicine that they need and then diverting part of it. That seems to be where a lot of it comes from. I don't think we know how much comes from various sources. I see some people will quote only 2 to 3% of the drugs on the street come from the internet, for instance. I think it's probably more than that when you read the newspaper and see some of the busts they've done with large quantities of people trying to import these things. And I don't know whether we know how much of these may be brought in and sold from some other place by drug gangs, etc. So we don't know that. But we do know how much is prescribed. We know who gets it. We know who's prescribing it. So that seems to be where the focus is.
The problem that you point out, and I want to make the distinction here, you say some folks develop tolerance and others develop addiction. Can you clarify what's meant by that?
Well, opioids or opiate drugs have a lot of different effects, and one of the effects is that of pain relief. The other effect that they have, that in some people, probably somewhere around 20% of the population, is a pretty intense euphoric effect, particularly when you first take the drug. Some people actually get dysphoric on these drugs, and so they're not going to abuse them, but about 15-20% will perceive a pleasant enough situation that their brain basically thinks this is something really good that I need a lot of, and eventually they get addicted to it. Tolerance to that develops very rapidly, so that to get that euphoric effect, you pretty rapidly have to escalate your dosage. So addicts can take 10 pain pills at a time to get high. The tolerance to the pain-relieving effect doesn't develop near as rapidly as the tolerance to the euphoric effect of these drugs. So people can get sometimes prolonged pain relief over time from relatively small quantities of narcotics. So that's kind of, and there's other effects they have that tolerance can build up to, but that's kind of the short version of that.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Dr. William Yarborough, who is the medical director of the Internal Medicine Clinic at OU here in Tulsa, and also the medical director at 12 and 12. You talked about physiologic tolerance. Is it an inevitability that any patient on chronic opioids develops tolerance, or are there exceptions to that?
I think it's inevitable that they will develop some tolerance. The rate of tolerance development, though, really varies a lot between individuals. Some individuals get really subtle tolerance over time. Others get more rapid tolerance. So I think you could say that the vast majority of people will develop some tolerance, so that if 3 pain pills was relieving your pain for a year, probably within 2-3 years, you may have to take 4 pain pills or 5 pain pills to get the same effect. And that's what tolerance is about. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish tolerance from progression of the illness that they might have. Maybe their arthritis is getting worse. Maybe their back's getting worse, so they need more. So sometimes it's difficult to determine. If you see really rapid tolerance develop, you really have to be suspicious that addiction is developing and that their brain is really wanting this drug for something else, not pain relief. It's crying out for it, but it's for the euphoric effect.
So rapid escalation, much more consistent with addiction than with tolerance. But if it's a very gradual increase, more suggestive of tolerance, is that a good rule of thumb?
Yes, that's a very good.
Now, the problem with addiction leads to, you pointed out, a sort of a shadow economy of people who are diverting drugs. And I think it's hard for us to know. I mean, you said there are estimates of 2 to 3% of the supply coming from the internet, but your estimate is it's likely more. Do we have a knowledge of just how big the problem is of diversion? Because I get notices from, say, the FDA, and I feel like doctors are often caught between complaints that we aren't good at treating pain and we don't do it adequately, and then you see the other side of that is you got to be extra careful because you basically don't want to lose your license for overprescribing.
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, I think, you know, doctors have broad discretion over how they prescribe medication as long as they're functioning as a doctor and documenting what they're doing. Used to have less, but we are expected to do certain things to look at diversion. For instance, Oklahoma has the best system in the United States for monitoring prescriptions online, the prescription monitoring program that the Bureau of Narcotics operates. It's real time. I think it's the only one in the United States that's basically real time. So when you look on there and you see them, they're going to five different doctors getting large prescriptions for opiates, then you would highly suspect they're diverting or possibly a really bad drug addict. They're not always diverting. Some of them just have that degree of habit. But that's the point in time that you don't want to participate in this. The problem is that since no one really communicates very well, you just dismiss them from their practice, and maybe they wander off to another doctor who doesn't check this, at least the first time they see them, and gives them another prescription. So because of privacy laws and other things, we have problems with this. For instance, if a drug agent or a policeman calls and says, you got a patient there that we're concerned about doing something, you know, the answer might be, well, I can't confirm they're even my patient. Now, you know, if you're crafty enough, you say, well, I'll listen to you. I can't talk to you. But we don't communicate. I think the enforcement people see doctors, as you alluded to before, as potential perpetrators. And so they're kind of, when they do talk to you, they're kind of standoffish, like, well, we don't know about you. You might be part of the problem. You might be inadvertently. And we don't really trust them because we don't communicate. And so we don't communicate with anything. I mean, we've discovered patients, for instance, that were in drug court that were coming and trying to get in. So I'm not blaming anyone. It's just that with all this communication stuff out there, there's not one place to go look or even allowed to inquire sometimes about a given patient because of privacy laws, which are necessary. But I think what's happened is when you try to solve this kind of problem, everybody's working in some different mode. You know, the drug people are doing this, the doctors are doing this, the police are doing this, and nobody's talking much. And, you know, it would be nice, for instance, if they noticed an irregularity on somebody that they just let you know. So let you know a patient that you're seeing. That seldom happens. And so, they see you, well, you might be up to no good, which that happens with physicians, but that's pretty unusual. Most physicians want to do this correctly, and they want to help people. They don't want to knowingly contribute to this. So it would be nice if everybody could kind of get together and try to solve this problem, working together instead of kind of against each other. And I think that's a national. That's not just in Oklahoma. It's not anyone's particular fault. That's just how the system is. And so. Maybe there needs to be some discussions. There needs to be other people at the table when we look at public policy and stuff besides the enforcement people. Maybe there needs to be more physicians and more other people that understand these issues, and maybe we could come out with a better product on the end.
For example, you were telling me about a conference you went to where there were no patient voices represented.
Right. Well, I went to the National Prescription Drug Abuse Conference in Florida a couple months ago, and there were congressmen there and officials from the DEA, FDA, et cetera. And there was a lot of good discussions going on. But then I realized there were people there from all aspects of this, including the drug treatment community and others, but there really wasn't a voice for the patients. Right now, there are patients out there that survive because of pain medication or survive with their quality of life. And there are people that benefit from it. I think the question for the public it has to be, or for policymakers, is at what level do you have concern about the diversion of it and then deprive patients with legitimate need of their medication? And that's another reason why you need everyone at the table with this. Because most people at these, like this conference, would say, we want to make sure that this is available for those who need it. But then the question then comes, well, who decides who need it? And in our system, the doctor is the doctor, the physician, or sometimes nurse practitioners that have these licenses that have discretion to give this medication. And sometimes we're not correct in what we do on both sides. Sometimes we don't treat people who should be treated, and sometimes we treat people and we've probably been conned. I think it's pretty rare to see a physician, though, that knowingly participates in the diversion of drugs. It certainly happens, and certainly Florida had a lot of experience with that back a few years ago. But I think we ought to all work together and get these barriers down instead of this kind of, we got you, or, you know, that sort of thing. I think that's going to harm patients in the end. Maybe it will decrease the amount of drugs on the street, but I think we need to talk about the prescription drug abuse problem is not a prescription drug abuse problem that we're talking about. It's an opiate problem. And what's happening right now in Tulsa, Oklahoma, is that it appears that the streets are flooded with heroin, which is an opiate that has been used illicitly. It's diacetylmorphine. And they've seen this in other locales where you decrease the amounts of prescription drugs on the street through enforcement efforts and doctors prescribing less, and suddenly here comes heroin. Because you've got this culture out there of people who are already addicted. You've got a culture of people who are heading that direction, and so there's a market. And so heroin fills that market. I was shocked 3 years ago talking to a young girl from a small town south of here who was 18 years old and had a heroin habit. And I talked to her for a while, and I discovered that she could buy an oxycodone to take for $60, or she could buy a bag of heroin that lasts 3 days for $50. And she could smoke it, sniff it, shoot it, whatever, to get it in her system. And then I asked her where she got it, and she got it right there in her little town.
Wow.
And that was several years ago. 10 years ago, we would rarely see heroin in Tulsa. There was a little bit of heroin brought in allegedly by some of the West Coast gangs, supposedly, into North Tulsa, but we rarely saw it. Now it seems to be everywhere. And so this is a natural progression of the opiate epidemic, if you will. That's a bigger problem. It's fairly easy to pick on doctors writing too many prescriptions. It's another thing to get in the middle of the drug cartels that are shipping heroin in as professionals. We're not professionals at that. So what we're experiencing here is not just about prescription opiate drugs. It's about opiates, whether they be illicit opiates or not. And maybe people are waking up to that. I don't know. It doesn't seem like they seem to be fixated on the prescriptions whenever this is going on.
Yeah, you certainly do seem to see a lot in the media about prescription drug abuse, overuse leading to abuse, and then several high-profile indictments of physicians who have been, you know, involved in so-called pill mills,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily in Oklahoma, although some, but West Coast, East Coast, those types of things, and you see a lot of that. Let's talk for a moment about treatment. You're the medical director at 12 and 12. How did you get involved in that?
I went out there about 20 years ago to kind of oversee their detox, and department chairman wanted to have a place where our residents could get experience, and so I got interested in that as an academic endeavor and sort of became an addictionologist over time. So I'm board certified in addiction medicine.
And you run a pain management clinic and treat patients with addiction in your internal medicine practice.
Yes.
And so at 12 and 12, how have you seen things change over the years in terms of treatment protocols for various types of substance abuse?
Well, I would say 10 years ago, the majority of patients we admitted were alcoholics, probably 50 to 60%. Second most common then was probably methamphetamine. And then way down the list was opiates. I think in the last few years, opiates have probably outpaced methamphetamine, although I'm not sure they're worse than methamphetamine. But they, as far as admissions to detox, the age of the patients admitting are younger. We're now seeing 19, 20, 21-year-olds that have been using opiates for 2-3 years and are addicted. We still see older people, occasionally see a legitimate chronic pain patient that just happens to be an addict and they get strung out on drugs, and we try to pull them back and find some type of way to treat them and also treat their pain. So it's changed quite a bit. The opiate problem has changed treatment quite a bit. And the outcomes of opiate treatment in the abstinence format is not as good as alcohol, for instance. People don't stay clean.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Dr. William Yarbrough from University of Oklahoma, Department of Internal Medicine, where he is the medical director of the clinic there, as well as the medical director at 12 and 12. And you mentioned the difficulty in going essentially clean from opiates. And so I think what you're getting at there is the use of long-acting substitutes like methadone and the newer drug, Suboxone. Is that?
Yes, I think people need to understand potentially some of the differences in that when somebody that's addicted and severely dependent on opiates comes in, they have a pretty intense acute withdrawal syndrome that can last anywhere from 5 to 7 days. With methadone, it can last even longer. And they get over that acute sickness usually within 5 to 6 days, and we give them some medications to help with that. But why they don't stay clean, physiologically at least, even when they go through treatment, go to 12 steps programs, is that there's a prolonged, what we call subacute withdrawal, that can go on for months. And what occurs with that is, we really don't have time to go into the full physiology of this, is that they basically have no energy, they have no appetite, they just have this kind of depression-like symptoms. It's really not depression, you know, it's physiologic, and they feel so bad, they're so fatigued, they don't sleep, that they just pick up and use again. I mean, I've talked to lots of people. After a month, they've been clean 6 weeks. And this often happens. They go to a treatment center for, say, 30 days, and they do okay there because the demands at a treatment center are not great. Nobody's out there making you do construction or unload produce or anything. So they don't have much to do. So we try to get them to do exercise because it can sometimes help this. So they get out, and then they realize, I'm not very functional. I don't have any energy. I don't want to get up. I don't have any motivation. And a lot of times they enter young. A lot of these people are young. They don't have a lot of experience. And they feel, this is what I'm going to feel. I'm just going to use because I can't feel like this. And so drugs like methadone, which was the classic one, and then more recently Suboxone, short-circuit that effect, particularly Suboxone, which is a partial activator of the receptors in your brain for opiates, and hopefully fools the brain into thinking that they're not having this. Basically activates the receptor enough to so that their energy comes back, their motivation comes back. And so you get this aid to help you stay clean. And studies would show that using Suboxone, the outcomes as far as getting people back to work, getting people back to school, getting people with their taking care of their children is far higher with the addition of Suboxone to their treatment than it is without it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of myths and misconceptions about this drug because it is an opioid-like substance. It does activate the mu receptor, the opiate receptor in the brain, and in some people, enough to really kind of be abusable. Although I've yet, in my 20 years and seeing thousands of opiate addicts, I've yet to see anyone who preferentially abuses Suboxone or buprenorphine. This is misunderstood often by the enforcement people, and because it is on the street, it is purchasable on the street, people will take it when they don't have anything else because it keeps them from being sick. And, you know, there are reports of some people preferentially abusing. I haven't seen it personally. I believe it may exist because everybody's brain's a little different, but it's pretty low. So I think sometimes when things have a street value, it doesn't mean that people are out doing lots of bad things with them. Most people would say it's just like, I can't get my heroin, and if I take one of these, I won't get so sick. And so the supply of this is limited, and the number of patients you can treat is limited because of kind of what I think is a misplaced paranoid about the street use of this drug. You know, I see, like I said, I've seen thousands and thousands of opiate addicts, and I've yet to see somebody that preferentially abuses Suboxone.
Now, I've seen on blogs that I read and things in the medical community, several physicians who have sort of staked out a position and said that they feel like they've been swindled too many times or they don't really want to contribute to this shadow economy of diversion, you know, certainly, well, intentionally or unintentionally. And so what they've decided to do is no longer prescribe narcotic strength drugs for anyone barring someone near the end of life or who has cancer or so basically for non-cancer chronic pain. They think it's counterproductive to prescribe narcotics. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I have that thought go through my head almost every day in what I do. Some days can feel pretty cynical about it because, you know, we catch people doing things, you know. But I've been a doctor for over 30 years, and I grew up in a time when it was like that, when even treating cancer pain was somewhat risque. As a doctor, and you might expect getting a call from your local whatever that you're prescribing over 100 pain pills, you know, you must be doing something wrong. Then the system sort of evolved into where just treat everybody's pain. Just give them whatever they need. So we went through that in the late 80s and 90s. And I think we went overboard with that. I think we went way overboard with that. I think it was well-intentioned. And we have a lot of patients left over from that that take high-dose narcotics, and it's hard to get them down from that. You know, they're not motivated to. They have physical problems, and they still want to take their high doses of narcotics. I think we have to take that in consideration because they didn't ask to be this way a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that people who prescribe these drugs in larger quantities should have some knowledge of the physiology of these or pharmacology of these drugs and have some knowledge of addiction. I think that some of the licensing people and others will tell you that this is an educational issue. We don't teach this in our medical schools. We don't, you know, the main reason people go to doctors is for pain, some pain symptom, and yet it occupies about 2 hours of the curriculum in medical school. And addiction probably usually consists of some psychiatry lectures and maybe a recovering physician coming in telling you how I used to be an addict, now I'm not, which that's fine. All those things are important. It's just that we don't really teach this. So doctors get out and face this, and some really caring doctors get sucked in to this. And then and the way to avoid it is just say no from the doctor's standpoint is to tell patients. I personally believe that this is a primary care competency that primary care doctors should have to a degree, that when you get to the more difficult patients, you probably should refer them to somebody with a little more experience. I use the story of the little old lady with arthritis that needs 3 pain pills a day. The primary care physician should be willing to do that and be knowledgeable to do that. The veteran who has multiple injuries that takes a half a ton of morphine a day, I'm just, you know, being facetious, probably needs to be managed by somebody that has more expertise in this and maybe doesn't need so much. So we don't have a good system. Some states have now talked about having mandatory dosage guidelines, for instance, for doctors for using these drugs. That may be something that's could be useful, I suppose. And it depends on what you're trying to prevent. Are you trying to prevent accidental deaths? Are you trying to prevent addiction? Or what are you trying to prevent? I think the focus has been on deaths, because a lot of the deaths have been people who aren't drug addicts. They're 17-year-old girls who somebody brings 2 large Oxycontins to a party and say, sniff these. She's never touched an opiate in her life, and she dies because she has no tolerance to these things. She's opiate naive. And then on the other end of that is the addict, you know, that becomes addicted. So it's a bigger problem than we, you know, than the supply, demand, et cetera. And that's why I really think we should all, there should be people talking that have knowledge. You know, the doctors should be talking to the narcs, you know, and the narcs should be talking to the doctors and not see each other as potential enemies. Unfortunately, that's the status. That's sort of how it is. But if we're going to solve this problem, or at least make efforts to solve this problem, there needs to be a clear understanding of what's going on with this and clear understanding of what can be done about it, and still preserve the ability for patients who have genuine pain problems to be treated appropriately.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time and your educational efforts. So thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Dr. William Yarbrough is the medical director of the Internal Medicine Clinic at the OU School of Community Medicine, as well as serving as medical director at 12 and 12 Incorporated Center for Addiction Treatment and Recovery here in Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa on Health for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.